The hour is coming. We have to start this meeting, so I call the order of the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee meeting for January 27th. And as long as I keep on asking people to approve the minutes, I stay in Rebecca's good graces. So I'm sure there's been more than one person that's been. Have you read it?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Mike Lemire moves the minutes of January 25th. All in favor of approving those minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. We're going to start out today with the apprenticeship program and... No? The committee administrator changed our rule, changed our order.
The apprenticeship program at Dolly.
Apprenticeship program at Dolly. Who's testifying? John Rakowski here? John Rakowski's not here, so Mr. Noble will start out with the auditor on the audit on the OICs. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Cecile Ferkel, who is the deputy legislative auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for inviting us to be here. We're here to talk to you about a financial audit report, a special review that we issued on January the 13th. And Ms. Ferkel is going to go through some of the details of the findings. What I would like to say to you is that I think this report illustrates a broad concern that we have had over many years in the operation of state government. And let me illustrate it this way. If there's $10 in the state treasury, we all understand that's public money, whatever, wherever it came from, whether it came from taxes, fees, or even sometimes a gift. If it's in the treasury, it's public money. And we understand that there are a lot of rules and standards and expectations for how that money can be spent and how it should not be spent and used. When you appropriate that money out of the treasury to a state agency, to DNR, Commerce, Health, whomever, those rules apply. And then if that agency grants that money to a nonprofit organization, and we grant literally hundreds of millions of dollars to nonprofit organizations, and they do a great deal of good service on behalf of the citizens of this state and for the state of Minnesota. But they need to understand that when they get that money under that grant or contract, it's still public money. And those same standards and expectations and rules apply. And sometimes that can be challenging for them because some nonprofits, a lot of nonprofits, have a mix of revenue. They may have money from the state, public money. They may have some private contributions and a variety of other money. So they need to have mechanisms to ensure that when they're spending public money, that they are adhering and complying with the standards and expectations and rules that attach to the use of public money. It is challenging, it is difficult, but if you want to take the public money, you have to accept that as an obligation. And we have, frankly, over the years, gotten into some special reviews for very specific reasons and traced public money through the agency to the nonprofit and found that those rules and expectations and principles have not been complied with. Because you have in front of you a report that gets into a lot of details about how certain public money was spent, I need to make it clear that we don't have the resources to dig this deep very often. As I said, there's hundreds of millions of dollars. There are thousands of nonprofits that receive money. And so at the Office of the Legislative Auditor, we cannot go this deep for every dollar that comes out of the Treasury. Which leads me to my second point. The state agencies that make those grants have an obligation to ensure that they oversee that money and ensure that it is used in an appropriate way, in compliance with the grant agreements, with the contracts, with various other rules and expectations that apply. And again, we often find that state agencies aren't providing adequate oversight. And so we found both problems in this report. We found that some public money was used in a way that we don't think was appropriate, and we think that the department did not adequately oversee at their end. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I might turn to Ms. Ferkel and we'll go through the specifics of the finding.
Welcome to our committee, Ms. Ferkel. Would you give your name for the record?
Thank you. My name is Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor in the Financial Audit Division. And it was within my division that we did this extended review of the expenditures at the Opportunities Industrialization Center's State Council. The reason why we did that, we were already in the Department of Employment and Economic Development looking at a broad range of grants and the department's oversight of those grants. One of the grants that we chose to review was this money that flowed through to the OIC. In looking at what was being reported by the OIC up to the department and the degree of oversight by the department, we thought we saw some things that indicated to us a risk of misuse of funds or inappropriate use of funds at the OIC level. So we did decide to extend our audit to look more closely at their expenditures. I'd like to, if you don't mind, recognize Brad White, who is the audit manager on this job, and also Sonia Johnson, who is our Director of Investigations. They were instrumental in doing the work behind this report. So to quickly kind of walk you through the report, I hope you all have copies of it. If we can first go to pages 4 and 5, that's where we can see a financial context for what we were looking at. The State Council of the OICs is the entity that receives the money directly from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and they flow it through, primarily flow those funds through to five local affiliates, and our review did not extend down to the local affiliates. If you look at the table 2 on page 5, you can see that they received $1.3+ million every year, but most of that money flowed through to the local affiliates, and that was not the focus of our audit. They did retain, though, each year about $200,000 to fund administrative expenses and their oversight and responsibilities for the OICs as a whole. And then Table 3 kind of provides you with a breakdown of how they used that money in each year. And in looking at these costs, even to narrow it down further, when we looked at the personnel costs and the accounting and audit fees, they did have independent audits each year, and also the contract services. Ultimately, we didn't really find questions in any of those areas, so our questions focused more on the travel, meetings, staff development expenses, and the miscellaneous expenses. So using that as a context, if we can...
Representative Clark has a question.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I wanted to back up just to some of your initial comments. If I understood, this extended review, I think you call it audit, was part of a larger audit that you did at Deed, is that right?
Ms. Burke?
Mr. Chair, member, we were looking at Deed's oversight of grants, kind of more broadly, certain of their grant programs and their oversight processes, and it was through that we saw some irregularities or red flags within this particular grant. Rather than delay the release of that report or bog that report, that audit down, we decided to do this review independently of that audit.
And Mr. Chairman, so Mark, what was the finding in terms of that department's irregularities overall?
Mr. Chair, members, we did make recommendations to the department. We did cite them for weaknesses in oversight and make recommendations to them to enhance and improve their oversight of grants that they made.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't quite ask that question right, I think. I meant dollar-wise, in terms of problems that you found at Deed, irregularities, concerns about use of funds, what was that amount?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have that amount off the top of my head. Did you?
The issue there was not there. That's not in that report. The issue about the misuse of funds came up in this report. The other report about oversight by Deed was more about their controls their oversight for grants. We got to the issue of specific amounts of money by going back and looking at this particular grant.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could be more specific. Were there not other misuses, or however you're labeling this, questions about misuse anyway, of funds for the department? And if so, I just wonder what that dollar figure was. I've heard some numbers, but I don't know, and I'm just trying to understand, like, you know, how do you decide what you're going to do an extended review on when there's a lot of other places as well? that have apparently within the department had questionable spending.
Mr. Chair and members,
let me preface this. We are not really going after Deeds report. I do have that in my office if you'd like to see it. And I'm sure Mr. Nobles would be glad to come explain the rest of Deeds report. What we're concentrating on now is the OIC portion of that report. And we are working to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen there again so we can have this behind us.
Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're doing, and I support that. I guess I'm just, maybe at another time, or after this, you can get me the information on, you know, I don't know what percentage this is of, you know, the overall problems that you found. I have heard that it's a very small percentage, that there's a lot more bigger problems. So I just wanted to know, and if there's a way we can get clear about that in terms of dollar figures, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair and members, if I could just respond briefly. This was the entity in our review of the grants where we saw clear indications of potential of misuse of funds that we believed we needed to follow through on. We didn't find other examples of that, although we certainly found other examples where the department could have done a better job of oversight. But their weaknesses didn't present to us apparent misuse of funds. This was the one that did. So it isn't that we made a choice between other entities and decided to pursue this one. This was the one that showed us evidence of misuse or potential evidence of misuse.
Okay, thank you. You want to go ahead and continue?
So there are three findings in the report. The first one, if you turn to page 8 and look at the last two paragraphs on that page, that really pretty much sums up the substance of the first finding. It's that the council did not fulfill its responsibility to ensure it properly used and accounted for its state grant and private grant funds. And then the next paragraph talks about the Department of Employment and Economic Development, that they did not ensure that the State Council had controls in place to ensure that the funds were properly used. So really the first finding is about the processes, the internal controls, both at the State Council level and at DEED. In finding two, we focus more on the particular expenses. And as I said before, we didn't really find problems with compensation, with audit costs and other kinds of contract costs. And so what we were focusing on was about $75,000 that was spent over a three-year period. And of that amount, we are questioning about $20,000 of it. So this is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, this isn't a lot of money. But as we look down at this level, we did believe that they needed to have better support and better accountability for how those funds were used. We broke that roughly $20,000 down into two groups. One is a group of costs that were undocumented, where there really was not sufficient evidence, documentation, like a receipt for a purchase or support for who attended a lunch that was paid for with state dollars. There wasn't sufficient evidence to show to us that those funds were an appropriate use of state grant funds. The other group is what we're calling inappropriate costs. In that case, there was evidence available, but as we reviewed that evidence, we were unconvinced that this was an appropriate use of state grant funds. And then that finding goes on to identify particular costs that we are questioning, describing the types of costs that were unsupported and also some of the specific costs then that we question. In the third finding, we have kind of an unusual issue. The OIC, it's a very small operation. There are three staff. One of those people is a part-time person, and their offices actually are in cubicles right in the heart of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We had two concerns with that. One is that they don't pay any rent or any kind of offset against their grant for that, so they're really getting an additional benefit from the state in terms of free rent and free, in some cases, even equipment and use of copy machines and phone service and email accounts, that type of thing, and that's as a supplement to the dollars that were appropriated by the legislature. And the other aspect of that is really more focused on the department, in that these are not state employees, and yet they're sitting physically sitting in the middle of a state agency where there's a lot of information, data. Much of it is, you know, we didn't really assess whether they were privy to things or not, but they have security badges that allow them into these secured state offices where, you know, most people are not, general public certainly is not allowed to go in. So we had both the data privacy and protection of data part of that too. So that was that's a really high level and quick overview of what the results of our audit revealed.
Okay. Any questions for members? Representative Haymar.
Well, I'm not sure if this is the right time or if someone from the administration is going to come up, and I'm looking at the response by Mr. Moe, the acting commissioner, who said that DEED doesn't have the ability to provide the appropriate level of oversight and monitoring. So what did we do?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, you know, again, we believe that this is part of the obligation that is with a state agency, is with the nonprofit. So if we're unable to carry out those essential functions of ensuring the appropriate use of public resources, I think departments and nonprofits need to come forth and make that clear to you. I think that would probably have some impact on your funding decisions. But it's their statement. I guess I would rather them tell you what they mean by that and what the implications are. But again, the obligations are there.
Mr. Chair, I assume someone from DEED will.
Well, certainly. Anybody from DEED in the audience?
Mr. Chairman, if we're going to exit at this point before they come up, I would just like to go back to Representative Clark's point, because I think it's an opportunity to make clear again to people how we get into these kinds of special reviews. And we have a very established process. As I think most of you know, the Office of the Legislative Auditor does evaluations and we do financial audits. Those activities are scheduled in advance. The audit of DEED is one that we initiated and scheduled. But we also receive a lot of other information throughout the year from citizens, from state agencies, from legislators, and there are things that we uncover ourselves in the process of doing our audits that indicate the need for some special attention to a particular program or nonprofit or state agency. We receive about 60 to 70 allegations a year from various sources, and we log all of them in, whatever they are, from whatever source. We log them in and we conduct a preliminary assessment of them, and that is the job of Sonia Johnson, who you see sitting there. It's a big responsibility to sort through. We go through a preliminary assessment to determine whether or not it's something that falls within our jurisdiction, whether or not it's something that we need to initiate an investigation of right away, if it's something we could fold into an audit, whether it's something we need to refer to law enforcement. So there's a set of considerations that we go through. But when we see a situation where we think there is good evidence, as Ms. Ferkel said, that there is an inappropriate use of public funds, we think we are the people that not only have the responsibility, but the tools in terms of our investigative ability to subpoena, to put people under oath, to get all of the information that we need, not only from a state agency, but from a private nonprofit organization as well. We will do that. It's a judgment that we make, but we make it every day. Sometimes it results in a special review report like you have in front of you. And so I think it serves not only the purpose of highlighting what is in this report, but what I said at the beginning and what I just mentioned to Representative Paymar, that public money comes with obligations, whether it goes to the state agency or it goes to a nonprofit. And I think we all have to figure out a way that we are going to fulfill those obligations, even when resources are tight and shrinking even further. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to step aside and let you speak to somebody from the Department of.
Well, first of all, I'd like to make a statement. In the recession, $4.3 billion recession we had in about 2003, Representative Paymar, it was suggested that councils of colors and other organizations take excess surplus state space instead of paying the rent that they were paying to make them more efficient for the month that we cut their budgets at that time. And I think that's an important thing for everybody to consider when they talk about space and deeds office for the OICs. Another thing is last year, Representative Rocavina and I took the auditor's report and we incorporated them into the omnibus bill for jobs and economic development finance at that time. So a lot of these things have been dealt with the deeds provisions already. So with that, I think that kind of explains some of it, but not all of it, I'm sure.
So, Mr. Chair, the letter from Paul Moe is dated January 10th, 2011, so I don't know what got corrected. The deed is saying they can't do it, unless I'm reading the letter wrong.
They couldn't do it. We read deeds report, and we went through it in committee, and Representative Rocavina put it in his omnibus bill and incorporated the findings of the deed legislative audit report in there.
Sure, maybe I'm misunderstanding it. January 10, 2011.
That's after that. I understand that. There again, I
don't want to be argumentative here, but it's January 10, 2011, this month.
That. Would you give your name for the record and give us all your insights, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Caligiuri, and I'm the Director of Job Seeker Services. It's a branch within DEED. I think what the answer refers to is a resource constraint that we as a state agency have, every state agency has, in regarding these grants, which we refer to as pass-through appropriations. You, the legislators, appropriate money. It has to, if it's for a non-state entity, it has to go through a state agency. Can't go directly to a nonprofit. And so in the big picture of things, as the chair just stated, we just went through a recession, got all kinds of federal money to help people who are unemployed. We have a limited number of staff and monitors. We didn't get any staff from the stimulus to increase our capacity to monitor and administer. We got some money to put staff temporarily in workforce centers to help the people who are unemployed. But with all of this obligation to report and do due diligence, when we get pass-through appropriations that there is no administrative funds for the agency to perform monitoring, we can only do at best what I would call a cursory job of monitoring. We do send monitors out at least once a year to do a site visit. We do review their plans. There is ongoing dialogue. But again, there is a resource constraint here because we do not, it's somewhat of an unfunded mandate because with all of the other very stringent federal and state programs that we have to administer and monitor, these additional pass-through appropriations or grants, we get no funding to do it. And we have a limited amount of staff. So it's a matter of trying to do much, much, much more with less. That, in a nutshell, is the fundamental problem with these grants or pass-through appropriations. And I think that any state agency would take the same position and say the same thing.
President Paymar, are you?
Well, you know, it's a explanation.
Okay. Representative Clark.
Just one other question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for reminding us about why we asked our agencies to take in some of the councils of color and so on. Are there other agents, other organizations that DEED also provides housing for in its on-site?
The only other organization I can think of is we have some federal staff, federal veterans employment staff that reside in DEED.
Mr. Chairman, and do they have similar access to the in-kind facilities that are being referenced here?
They have security access, but none of the private information is accessible to those employees. Unemployment insurance information is not accessible to me on the workforce development side.
Yeah.
I can't get at that information.
And, Mr. Chairman, I assume that's the same for the OICs?
That is the same for the OICs. There is security within the agency.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know. It just doesn't seem to me that it would be that difficult to monitor if there's a checkbook? I mean, there's got to be a way to see who spent what for what, and a cursory monitoring would identify inappropriate expenditures. I mean, any number of us people here, with all of our expertise around this table, are involved in either businesses or some type of group that we work with, and there is constant monitoring through checkbooks or whatever, and it doesn't take a lot of time. I'm just kind of aghast that why somebody wouldn't see that there was a problem with golf green fees and tournament entry fees. I mean, that would show up immediately if I looked at somebody's checkbook. I'm sorry to say that I don't think it takes a lot of meetings and reports. Can I see the checkbook and then go from there? And why not that?
Mr. Corky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jim Corky. I'm the Director of Adult Services and Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I just want to add on to what Mr. Caligiuri said and maybe respond to your question. We do get a lot of pass-through grants, and because of the number and the scope of them all, we don't have the resources. But in this particular case, since this has been brought to light, we've been working very closely with the OIC and their state council to look at the what has been raised as issues and concerns with their documentation. And their state council has already taken a number of actions that will address these issues. We're working with them. I think our response basically said that over the next few months we will look at all of these issues, and with the eye to really tighten up all of the processes and procedures into the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions for the people from D? Seeing none, we appreciate your input. Mr. Means, welcome to our committee. We're looking forward to your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members. My name is William Means. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota OIC State Council. Before I make my comments, I'd like to introduce our president of our board of directors, which represents all five OICs throughout the state, and have her make the opening comments.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Linda White. Chairman Gunther and members of the committee, first, we want to thank you for the opportunity to come before the committee and share stories of our work. We want to give an overview of the Minnesota OIC State Council. But to start out, we would like to acknowledge the report of the legislative auditor and assure this committee that we will continue to work with DEED. We will rectify the findings of the audit. They will not resurface. We will take the opportunity additionally to improve our financial, our administrative, and also our accounting procedures. We will follow up with the auditors and others to report our gradual process. So we do apologize that these issues have come up. We take them to heart. It is embarrassing that they are here before you. But we do assure that we will continue to be good stewards. And it is in the State Council office. It has nothing to do with the great work of the affiliate OICs, who all have taken their time to be here this afternoon and talk about their specific work. With that, I want to focus some of our information on the things that we have been doing with your help, with the citizens of Minnesota help, and our results in that regard.
Chairman Gunther and members, you have before you our legislative report, which in the past biennium has called for fiscal year 2010 some very clear statistics on the counties we serve, who we serve, placements, participants, the ethnicity of those. We serve 2,438 clients. 90% were economically disadvantaged, and 39% were welfare recipients. We also break those down by ethnicity. Our outcomes are clear. We enrolled 1,600 clients. We had 1,155 complete training. We placed 387 clients into full-time livable wage jobs, and that was 86% of our goal. You know, in this economy, I think that in and of itself was pretty good success for this past fiscal year. We had another 642 that advanced into other career training, and that's just the state grants. Under the overall grants, we served 2,400 people at 174% of our goal, with 1,530 completing training, and we placed 545 into jobs, which was 95% of our goal. And we had 770 additional people that advanced into other training and other careers. Average starting wage was $19,000 on those that were trained. Just to speed up this little presentation, we returned on investment $16.13 for every state dollar that we used. So we had a good, successful year. Exceeded our goals in many areas, and we've been a partner with D for about 27 years. Our first legislative bill was introduced in 1984. We have five OIC centers, one in Bemidji, one on the Mille Lacs Indian Reservation, and three in Twin Cities, one of which, the TTOIC, serves Spanish-speaking community not only in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but also in Wilmer, Minnesota, and soon to open up other sites in other areas such as Faribault, Owatonna, and some of the other areas where we have large Spanish-speaking populations. So I think we are, in fact, using the state's money well. I, as the executive director, I do take full responsibility for any misappropriation or any what's called disallowed costs, and we've taken the measures to remedy that situation rather than to depend on our accountant to decide where the expenses are charged. We now have developed a specific form to instruct our accountant to where to charge each specific expense. For example, there wouldn't be any golf tournaments that would go on state money. That is to assure you, because even though that was a fundraiser for an organization that was called Native Vote Alliance, to clarify that, because it stands out, and I've heard their comment many times. And it was a get-out-to-vote effort for Indian tribal nations throughout the state of Minnesota. We had tribal officials there, public officials, and so it wasn't just some kind of vacation outing. It was part of the political process. It wasn't our intent to charge it to the state. We have other income, which is both general operating and earned income, and then we have state money. So, my mistake, it got charged to the state in terms of how the legislative auditor looks at things. But it won't happen again. So I give that example of how we're improving our process. We have made administrative changes in both the area of accounting and as well as my position. So we look forward to continuing a good relationship, bipartisan relationship, with the state government as well as Department of Employment Economic Development.
Chairman Gunther, we do have two students from the OICs who would like to give remarks if there is time.
We'd love to have them. We don't have a lot of time, but we still like to hear what
All
they
right.
have to say.
Thank you. We'll call them forward.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Welcome to our committee. Give your names for the record so 100 years from now we can know you are here.
My name is Gerard Williams.
I'm Karen Austin.
I am currently a graduate of Summit Academy OIC, and I graduated and immediately following the next week got a job working real hard, get paid $19.38. Prior to Summit Academy, I was working at McDonald's, getting paid minimum wage 5 days a week, and I was going to school in the morning, going to work at night. I'm not here to say anything about anything else, but the fact of the matter is Summit Academy helped me. If it wasn't for them, I don't know where I would be doing or where I would be. The simple fact of the matter is I completed 20 weeks of intense training, and without that, I would not be able to be working in the construction field that I am. I am in a union, 49ers union, pay my dues before then. Actually, before I even went to Summit Academy, I did 5 years in prison, first and foremost. Immediately after I got out of prison, I signed up for Summit Academy. We're open and willing arms, they helped me out, and to this day, I continue to ride that righteous path of success. So you can take from it what you will or what you want, but it is people out here that need help and that are being helped by Summit Academy.
Thank you. Give your name for the record.
My name's Karen Austin. I'm a single mother of one. I've struggled financially for the past 10 years, and I've gone through all kinds of programs as far as workforces and Ramsey County, and they all tried to help me with jobs but didn't help, didn't find one. And I found jobs on my own. Finally, last year, I decided to go to American Indian OIC and better my skills. And I finished the program, and immediately after the program, I did find employment with an old employer, and I emailed her all my credentials, and she gave me a pay raise. And so I was able to pay all my bills, get caught up in my rent, and just feel like a better person for the community, you know. And so American Indian OIC, their classes tremendously helped me out, and I feel smarter, you know, with the classes. And I know that you know, I get better employment now, so just they've helped me tremendously.
Thank you both for your testimony. And members have any questions? No? Thank you. I think you both did very
Thank
well.
You.
We appreciate
you
coming here. That concludes your presentation of the OICs, Mr. Means?
We have all our OICs represented. If you think you've got a good cross-section of information, we'll leave that up to you.
It's funny, over the years, I think I've met them all.
We have the out-state people. We've got, you know, the Digi.
We appreciate you being here.
All right.
And I think there was a little misstep that has been explained very well, and I appreciate it, and I appreciate the state auditor for his diligence in making sure that our state is being very well represented by the people that we do invest our money in. So with that, we have Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I just didn't let the moment pass. I thank you for that comment that you just made. And I just wanted to recognize Mr. Means. I know that he's going to be retiring, and I want to thank him for his many decades of service to the state. And I think what's particularly impressive to me serving on this committee is the ratio of return on the dollar investment. You know, it's just, I don't think we'll run across any other, or very few if I can think of any other programs where that 16-to-1 return is present. So I want to thank you for that. I know that you've worked really hard at that. And so I just wanted to say that in light of looking at some of the problems or issues, it's also important to recognize the leadership that we've had from this organization. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to also call everybody's attention to the amount of money it costs to produce a good-paying job, and you do a wonderful job of doing that also. So with that, we have the Department of Labor and Industry and the Apprenticeship Association come down and welcome to our committee. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Peterson, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. It's a pleasure to be back before this committee.
Pleasure to have you back.
With me today, I've brought Jessica to discuss the apprenticeship program. I've brought Jessica Luman, Assistant Commissioner of Codes and Standards of the Department, and Rosalyn Wade, the head of our apprenticeship program and labor standards program. So I'm just going to say that the apprenticeship program is a great program. For years, we've been trying to devise ways to make it get more people involved with it, and hopefully we'll come up with some magic answers to that. But it's, what we do now is very effective, and hopefully make it better. But Jessica will go through the program itself.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Jessica. Very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jessica Luman, and I'm the new, 7 days in, Assistant Commissioner over at the Department of Labor and Industry. And Rosalyn is the director of those programs, and so she knows everything there is to know about these programs, so if we can't answer your questions, we'll certainly get you any responses that you might want. I know many of you are very familiar with this program, and we just want to give you a brief overview of what the Division of Apprenticeship does at the department. We have a couple of handouts here, just the department at a glance, if you will. Just for a little bit of information about what the program does. As you know, what apprenticeship is about is it's about developing skills for Minnesota workers to prepare them to meet the workforce needs of Minnesota employers. Apprenticeship is regulated by the federal government. The United States Department of Labor, under federal code of regulation, Title 29, Part 29, regulates all apprenticeship relationships. So our program runs under their program. We're what's called a SAC state, which is we have our own state apprenticeship committee agreement with the federal government, which allows us to basically customize the apprenticeship requirements for Minnesota and for Minnesota employers. The division itself is currently, its current biennial budget is about $1.5 million. We have 6.5 full-time employee equivalents, and we're funded actually through the Workforce Development Fund. In addition to the federal regulations, we also have the statutory obligations under Minnesota Chapter 178, and generally those include four broad areas. We have to approve apprenticeship programs. We have to approve apprenticeship agreements, which are the agreements between the apprentice and their employer, or the apprenticeship program sponsor. We promote equal opportunity in apprenticeship programs and other on-the-job learning programs. And we promote apprenticeship as a form of training and workforce development. So looking at each of those areas a little bit more closely, regarding the approval of apprenticeship programs, you have an apprentice and you have a sponsor. The apprenticeship programs are developed by the sponsors. There's a framework that's laid out for all apprenticeship programs. They include minimum job training requirements and rules and regulations in terms of how apprentices are treated under the programs. But in addition to the general framework, every apprenticeship program itself is customized for the training needs of the specific industry or the specific trade. So the programs and policies themselves are called standards. Each apprenticeship program has its own standard. And we approve those, We help them develop them. We approve them when they're developed, and then from time to time they need to get revised, modified. We also make sure that we monitor that they're living up to the obligations under the apprenticeship standards. We currently have 305 active registered apprenticeship programs with the department. These include programs that train everyone from automotive technicians, med techs, health support specialists, machinists, bookbinders, meat cutters, tool and die makers, and then the one that most people are familiar with, which covers almost every building and construction trade. Approximately 20% of the approved programs, the sponsors of the programs, only about 20% of the programs themselves cover building and construction trades, whether they're union employer programs, joint programs, or employer-sponsored programs for the building trades. But that being said, as we'll see later, a predominant number of the apprentices that are registered with our program are in the building and construction trades programs. For the approval of apprenticeship programs, we have a goal. We're always trying to improve, always trying to expand this program and making sure that it continues to work for Minnesota workers and employers. And our 2011 goal for the division is to increase the number of sponsors by about 10%. So create 10% more new programs to bring apprenticeship to Minnesota. And we're looking to do this primarily in non-building and construction trade industries. So the second goal of our division is to approve the apprenticeship agreements and register apprentices. A lot of you may have heard of a registered apprentice. What happens is when an apprentice becomes, we still use the word indentured, this is a very old concept, when an apprentice becomes indentured into an apprenticeship program, both the worker and the sponsor agree to make a commitment to the training. As of December 2010, we had about 7,000 registered apprentices in the state of Minnesota. As I said, about 85% of those are in the building and construction trades, about a little over 6,000 of them are. But because construction has declined so much, the number of registered apprentices, because there just aren't as many opportunities in the construction trades, the number of apprentices has dropped, and so the number of our apprenticeship registered apprentices has also gone down over the last 3 years. So the goal for our division is a sort of a more aggressive and a longer-term goal is to increase the number of registered apprentices in the state of Minnesota by about 2,500 in the next 2 years. The third responsibility for our division is to promote equal opportunity in apprenticeship. And statutorily, the purpose of apprenticeship is to open to young people, regardless of race, sex, creed, color, or national origin, the opportunity to obtain training that will equip them for profitable employment and citizenship. We've heard a lot about the OIC programs this morning, and one of the goals of the apprenticeship division is also to develop opportunities for people of color and women into apprenticeable trades so that they can get some of the best jobs and good paying jobs in Minnesota. To help achieve the equal opportunity goals, there's sort of three goals of ours. One is all apprenticeship programs themselves, every sponsor, every approved program has to have affirmative action goals. And we monitor those annually to make sure that every program is doing everything that it can to provide equal opportunity to bring new people into the trades that the apprenticeship programs are training in. The second part of it is that we do, as the division, we do a lot of outreach and education to develop community-based educational programs that lead to apprenticeship opportunities. And then also we have a small program called the LEAP Grant Program, which provides some direct funding for community-based organizations that are working to develop opportunities into the apprenticeable crafts. Currently, more than 1,000 of the registered apprentices, this is about 14%, are women and minorities. Our goal for 2011 is to increase minority and female participation by 10%. And finally, the division works to promote apprenticeship and other job training opportunities. We really see apprenticeship as one of those real win-win situations in economic development. We facilitate a partnership between employers and workers to really take it to another level in terms of meeting the needs of Minnesota. We're working to develop apprenticeship opportunities in industries in order to meet the training and emerging technology goals. For example, one of the programs we're working on right now is a apprenticeship for the printing industry to really address some of their specific needs, and we're working closely in partnership with them. So those are the four primary, again, this is a brief overview of our department. These are the four goals of our program. We welcome any questions that you might have about the way we, what we're doing in order to continue to develop apprenticeship. Thank you.
Welcome to our committee, Ms. White. I know you've been around this committee quite a bit over my 15 years. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Not particularly. Well, maybe I guess. I would like to indicate that we're currently operating. We are moving forward with both a state and federal initiative to expand apprenticeship opportunities to the non-construction trades. We are beginning to see some success. We're going back. The initiative with the printing industry, for many years, the printing industry was a big user of apprenticeship. However, with changes in technology, we've seen a decline. So this initiative really is to reach out to an industry where there is a proven track record. We're trying to build on all of our successes. We believe that apprenticeship is a formidable training model that can be used in diverse industries. We're looking at everything from particular areas in the healthcare industry, pharmaceutical manufacturing on the whole, but right now we're focusing and going back and trying to renew some of those partnerships, and we thought the printing industry is an ideal place to start because they have used apprenticeship. And we're trying to build on that success in every possible way. I think it's a good program, and certainly you already know I believe in it.
Well, with that, we have any questions from the member? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. I'm pleased that you're going to try to, it looks like, double your percentage of women and minorities in your apprenticeship program. Is that in the next 2 years, or is that, what is that goal? What time frame does that have?
The goal is to increase the participation of women and minorities by 10%. That's not, I don't believe that that's going to double it. But we all value and we're encouraging all of our sponsors to look at ways to more effectively recruit and retain women. Our work with community-based organizations is a great example of how, you know, we are advancing that goal. Apprenticeship, like registered apprenticeship, is impacted by the state of the economy, and our office do not make direct placements. So the number of apprentices is going to be reflected when the economy is doing poorly. It certainly have an adverse impact. Fewer employers are bringing on individuals to train because they're really trying to retain the employees that they have. So we are, at our agency and in our program, just really hoping and praying for an economic turnaround that we will see some potential growth. But we do put effort into ensuring that those sponsors who are in partnership with us are doing everything that they can to recruit and retain and certainly comply with the EEOC requirements for women and minorities in registered apprenticeship.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I read it wrong. What I have here is that 9% is your current percentage of total women and minorities who are in registered apprenticeship programs, and I thought if you were increasing it by another 10%, that would double it. So are you taking 10% of the 9% or 10% of the total?
Well, number one, the numbers, the percentage number changes as because there's constant apprenticeship being a training program. Some folks are going to graduate, some more are going to come in, so it's cyclical. The current number as of December 31st was greater than 1,000. Actually, I have a specific number here.
Mr. Chairman, it says 1,078, and
correct.
It says 9%.
Correct. We had been pretty steady at 9%. In looking back at the average percentage of women and minority participating in registered apprenticeship is about 9.4. The current statistic actually is better than that. So in looking at this in the most objective way, women and minorities are continuing to fare well in registered apprenticeship. With the total number being 1,078, that actually represents about 14% of the actual registered apprentices as of December 31st. But those numbers do change on a monthly basis. Our goal is to increase the current participation of women and minorities by an additional 10%. So it's not going to turn into 24%. That's fairly unlikely, but we do consider this a critical goal of the unit.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just want to be supportive of you going in that direction, that's for sure. I just wanted to ask a different question, which is, have you considered apprenticeships in the agricultural sector at all? I'm thinking of some of the stuff that's going on with both urban farming and rural farming. Is that ever come up as an opportunity, apprenticeships in the agricultural sector?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, our office will work with any employer, any industry in helping to develop an apprenticeship program. We've not to date received such a request. We are doing a lot of interesting things around energy. We've not moved into the agricultural, but certainly we're not prohibited from doing so. We are responsive to industry needs, so if you identify those users out there, we would take the initiative to contact them.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my first time on this committee, so I feel like this might be a really dumb question, but
So
bear with me. I'm just kind of curious with the state apprenticeship program through DOLI. As you talked about the construction trades industry, I'm wondering if you work with existing unions like the St. Paul Trades and Labor, or are you in competition with unions? I'm just trying to figure out the partnership there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I completely hear the question. The way that typically works is that the union and the employers with whom they collectively bargain will create a joint, it's called a JATC, Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee, and they will develop the program that they need for their industry, and then they'll come to us and say, this is our program. Does it meet the requirements of the federal and the state laws? And we'll work with them to make their program work. So we really facilitate industry creating their own apprenticeship programs. We don't perform training, and we don't compete, to answer your question. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, just to clarify, it's not just union. It can also be not union employees. It can also be non-union employers with their employees.
Absolutely.
Representative Mulry, are you finished?
I am. Thank you.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Wade, is it true that you know everything, like she said?
I think so.
Just to follow up a little bit on the issue of people of color, what is done to recruit them, and how do the different state agencies work together? Because that's an issue that they all have. And I know at one time, before the governor rolled Dewar into MMB, there was a separate part of DOER that was supposed to make sure all agencies were doing that and working together, and I know that got zeroed out and abolished. So is there any plans under the new administration to start working again with different agency, because each one has that problem? And I don't, it looks like Ken's
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulray, the new administration is, we're exploring ways of better cooperating on issues like that. Hopefully we'll have something done in the next few months. Right now we don't have anything, but we are exploring, trying to figure out. That's one of the areas we identified as worth looking at very seriously. I have nothing to report other than that.
Very serious problem, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, because we require minority hiring of people to contract with the state, and the state itself has one of the worst records of that in the state. So I'm glad that you're talking over and working on that.
Commissioner.
He's right. We're working on it. We identify as a problem, and we'll hopefully be doing more on it.
I have a question. What are there any opportunity for apprenticeship programs in Greater Minnesota? And if so, where? And how do they all have to come up here? Mm-mm. Love to hear. That's where I'm from, Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, you've got...
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, certainly we are housed down here, right down the street, in Lafayette Park. However, our office services the entire state. Certainly the majority of registered programs follow the population of the state, and about 85% of the programs are right in the 11 county metro area. However, we avail ourselves, our staff have geographic territories covering all parts of the state, and we do have some representation of registered apprenticeship in most every county. So we are looking at, as we attempt to promote and expand apprenticeship opportunities, we're constantly looking for those areas that have been untapped.
Can I just add something to that, Mr. Chairman? In terms of in Faribault County, there are two apprenticeship programs, and in Martin County, there are three apprenticeship programs that we have on our list right now. Okay. So they are existing there.
Good.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to mention to the committee that before coming down today, I went on the department's website, and if you do a search in their search window, mm-hmm. and you put in apprenticeship, you'll be directed to the apprenticeship program, and there's a link that shows all of the apprenticeship. Certified apprenticeships throughout the state. It's pretty amazing. It covered just about every county, I think, just about. So if you want to look at that, it's available to you.
I just want to issue a notice also that Representative Murray and I are trying to change this population growth problem you're having up here. We're going to try to suck all the things out in Greater Minnesota. So you might be moving.
Mr. Chairman,
I get a question out of you.
I was just looking in the audience, and he can nod yes or no, Pete. But I believe that, Mr. Chair, you funded in the last bonding bill, wasn't it? The Tenors, didn't Marchetti get a training facility up there for apprentices? Yeah, the Tenors got one, and you funded it. So, thank
Great
you.
Thank you for enlightening us all. Is there anything any other members have a question about? Seeing none, thank you for the very enlightening presentation, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to cover. Okay. With that, seeing no questions, we are adjourned. Thank you very much for a good.